For those who want to join in the chanting, there are chanting books in the back. If you haven't got one already. But if you don't know the words, you can always hum the tune. Ajahn Chah would teach me when I first became a monk, and all the monks are chanting blessings. If you don't know the chant, just move your mouth. So it would look like you were chanting. It's called, he was the founder, precursor of what we call lip syncing. Way before Madonna, we had Ajahn Chah. Okay. Those who don't want to lip sync, there's books there. And we start, I think it's page 17. Is that right? Yoso, or 18? What page? Yo, so. Very good. Here we go. It is.
Page 8.
8. Oh, that's a very lucky number. So it is. On page 5.
It's fine.
It means progress, lucky. Okay. So those who are ready, first of all, because you're not supposed to have been talking very much. First of all, to clear your throat. Okay, very good. Now we can do the chant. Because he's bowing, I usually sit on my haunches. So here we go.
Yo-so Bhagavan.
Namo tassa bhagavato.
Tipiso Bhagava Arahant Sama Sambuddho Vija Charana Sampanno Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purisadhamma Sarati
is followed by the Metta Sutta, which is on page 18?
15.
That's even a better number. I'll make it up as I go along. Okay, you ready? A one, a two, a one, two, three. Come on.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Skillful nor proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Peace, sadhus.
Sadhu.
Sadhu. Big one. Sadhu.
Oh, good stretch.
There we go. So that's the chanting. Now we've got even more questions. Oh my goodness, you are right. How do we cultivate kindness for the moment when it is unpleasant, e.g. painful, cold, etc.? Thank you. It could be worse whenever it's really cold. I remember the story of these Tibetan monks when they were living in Tibet, and they would be going in the caves in solitude, and they didn't have heaters in the caves, they didn't have aircon in the caves. They learned how to create their own inner heat, and they were tested after doing a special meditation to really get the heat coming up. Then they had a test. They would go out into the middle of winter in the snow field, and then they would sit next to, in the snowfields, all night with no robes on. But they were allowed one blanket. No robes, but just a blanket. Because a blanket would be dipped into the icy water first. And they put that around them. And to pass the test, they had to dry 3 blankets before dawn from really wet, icy, over their body and steam it off. And when I think of that, I think, this isn't cold. So, but you know, if you think it's cold, then your thoughts make it even colder. And anyway, if it gets really cold, you don't feel it anymore. You're numb. You want this online? Okay, I can't do it. Now I've got to behave. I can't tell these
stories.
Okay, so here we go. So, when it's really cold. So, kindness. Oh, so wonderful that it's cold. Yes, but because it's nice and cold, we don't have heaters, or we turn off the heaters, we don't use the high air conditioning. It means we're delaying climate change. But hang on, for climate change, isn't it going to get warmer and warmer? That's probably why you're not really so interested in stopping climate change, because it means you can come to Perth and be nice and warm for you. Is that right? I often thought that the rise in sea levels, that means Jarna Grove will really be a resort. You'll have a beach just down over there. But anyway, I'll get in trouble for this. Actually, why? Take these things more seriously. You cultivate kindness in the moment when it's unpleasantly painful, cold, etc. Because you know it will pass. As I said today, that anything which is unpleasant, it can't last. And it will always be followed by something pleasant. When something pleasant passes, it'll be unpleasant again. This is just the dance of suffering and happiness, the Vedana. And you can't avoid that. So, what can we do? It's painful. Let's say it's cold or it's too hot. We should have personal air conditioning. So you can pull it down here and you can adjust the temperature just around your own little bubble. So you're just the right temperature, because what is cold for you is hot for me. In fact, it's pretty hot this today. Can we turn on the aircon, please, to 16? So different people, different metabolisms. So the kindness for the moment is that, yeah, it is unpleasant. It's painful. But we learn from it. We grow from it. This is welcome to life. So if there's something you can do about it, great. But a lot of time you can't. So I'm going to open the door of my heart to these feelings. A lot of time, if it's like pain, physical pain, I accept you, pain. You're part of life. But sometimes I think of pain as this being which no one else likes, which everyone is afraid of. And then I befriend my pain. Ah, poor pain. No one else likes you, but you can come and stay with me. When you're nice and kind to that pain, the pain, oh, at last somebody likes me. And it comes and nestles in your lap, and then the pain changes to something which is much more comfortable and peaceful. The biggest problem, the two types of pain, are the mental and the physical. The physical pain, you can't do much about. It's part of having a body. But the mental pain, ooh, you can do everything with that. And it's weird, 99% of the pain is mental. Physical is only a tiny part. Which is why you can go and ask, you can find him on the other side of the road, Amandus. Because I saw this with my own eyes, that he was coming back from the workshop with some pliers and a tooth in it with blood all over it. It was his tooth. He'd taken out his own tooth in the workshop. How do you do that? Any dentists here? He'd taken out his own tooth. So I said, well, what'd you do that for? I said, well, you know, it costs a lot of money going to the dentist. And he says, got to take such a long time. You make an appointment. It's either cancelled or you have to wait. And then, oh, it's just so much bother. And he said, you've got a workshop there. You've got a care pliers. Take it out yourself. I said, well, how can you do that? And that's when he's taught about present moment awareness. So when I decided to take out my own tooth, that never hurt. When I walked to the workshop, that never hurt. When I picked up the pair of pliers, that doesn't hurt, picking up a pair of pliers. When I put the pair of pliers on the tooth, that never hurt. When I wiggled it, that hurt, but only for maybe about 10, 20 seconds, and then it was out. And afterwards, it didn't hurt that much, the same as if you'd gone to a dentist. And I never got any bill, and that never hurt at all. But the point is, when I tell that story, even just telling that story, I saw a few people making a face, ooh, it hurt you, and it wasn't even your tooth. Can you see the mental pain? So a lot of times, if we understand that when there is pain, a lot of time it's our reaction to it is one of the worst parts of it. It's what we add on to physical pain. The two arrows, or the two darts you're shot with, said the Buddha, the physical arrow and the mental arrow. Physical pain, can't do much about. The mental reaction you can do a lot about. And that's exactly what I was telling you in meditation. When you take a pain, you relax it. And it's just a bit of an irritation, that's all, but not a pain. It totally changes it. So that's why you don't need to be a victim of pain or a victim of cold. So that's what you can do. And it's a lot of time, it's sort of open the door of your heart. Okay. In the Anapanasati Sutta, after the instructions of being mindful of the breath, it seems to skip into wisdom practices, such as aware that it is just the breath, is the same nature of others' breath. Okay, that wasn't the Anapanasati Sutta. That was the Satipatthana Sutta. But nevertheless, it was just using a part of the Anapanasati and just connecting it to the Satipatthana. And then enough for the mindfulness of wisdom necessary for liberation. Since mindfulness is already present before watching the breath, what kind of mindfulness does this later part refer to? Superpower mindfulness? Pretty good. Or the mindfulness of anatta? Pretty good. Is this where we know it's just the breath, not my breath? Please explain the kind of mindfulness necessary for liberation. So, in what I read out this afternoon, you've already restrain the hindrances. So when you restrain the hindrances, you get more mindful. And it's something which will come up later in this retreat. As the hindrances get sort of restrained more and more, your mindfulness gets stronger and stronger. And exactly the power mindfulness, the superpower mindfulness, this is when, even when you go and have your breakfast, oh, there I'm going again, talking about food this time of evening. I'm sorry, but I started now. And what was it? Not this year, but the year before when I had my two-week retreat in my cave, and I came out after my two-week retreat in the cave, really nice and peaceful and blissy. And then the first breakfast which I had, and after the retreat, had some baked beans. And I just put them in my mouth. Now, the ordinary baked beans out of a can. And it was like a taste explosion. I never tasted anything so rich and so sort of, the tanginess of the tomato sauce. And the texture was just soft, but not too soft. It didn't sort of melt in my mouth. You just had to chew it slightly. And it was just a perfect texture for one bean. And it was sweet and just a tiny bit salty, and just the way the salt and the sweetness and the tomatoness of it, the acidity of the tomatoness interacted with the soft texture of the bean. And that was just amazing. And I had to stop myself and go, wow, that was the best baked bean. It was just outside from a can. It wasn't made by Gordon Ramsay or something. Is that right, Gordon Ramsay? Okay, yeah. It was just baby from a can. But my mindfulness was so incredibly strong. It was just, wow, that was amazing. You just had to let it linger in your mouth, until the explosion of taste and flavour and sweetness and tanginess subsided. And then you could swallow it and have another one. So that's what superpower mindfulness is like. It gets really, really strong. And it's not just seeing sort of baked beans and just, number one, it was impermanent. Oh, and it was gone. Didn't last long in my mouth. And also, it's to see like the breath. That's all it is. It doesn't belong to you. It's just an automatic process. And it's part of this body which doesn't belong to you. It just comes and goes. Your body, how many bodies have you had? Heaps and heaps and heaps and heaps. We'll talk about that maybe later on. But this body, would you like to be healthy? Does it depend upon you? Sometimes I wonder, who does this body depend upon? Who owns my body, this body? I call it my body. And sometimes people always honour me, do more exercise, do some weight, blah, blah, blah. It just shows it's not my body. You always tell me what to do. If it was my body, I'd say, sure, well, it's not up to you to tell me what to do. It's my body. I'll look after it. Or then sometimes you say, well, I should eat. And sometimes you put food in my bowl, even without my permission. So it's not my body, you know. Because after 44 years, you've been feeding me. So, you know, if I'm fat, it's your fault, not mine. It's true, you feed me. But you've done a pretty good job, I reckon. You've kept me healthy for such a long time. And it's a long time since I've had a sickness or an illness. Maybe sometimes you have a little cold for maybe a day or two, but when was the last time I was sick? Really sick. What did I do? Fever? I didn't have a flu. Oh, I had indigestion. That was true. That's what I really get. And it was like it was a bit of a fever at night time, just from the flu. Not the flu, from the my birthday lunch. I don't know what they put in there. I think it was ginger soup or something, I thought. That was all. It was weird because I was really hot and couldn't understand just why I was so hot in the cave. And it's obviously just my temperature was up. So anyway, some pretty good health. So anyway, that's what happens, that it's just body, that's all. Can't control it. So anyway, the full Satipatthana, I've only just got the first part of it. So maybe just do more about that question tomorrow. You translate Satipatthana as the focus of mindfulness, but many other translators have translated as the foundation of the development of mindfulness. And I disagree with them. The word Patthana in Pali also means to develop. It doesn't actually mean develop, it means that the basis. Even the Thai word Patthana, develop, comes from Patthana, is Thai. Patthana, not Patthana. What is the choice of the word focus of mindfulness? It is because a word's meaning changes. Like even in Thai, we have someone who's whipalat. It's crazy, it's mad. And it comes from whipalasa, which means something totally different in Pali. It means the perversion of perceptions. You have the word in Pali, yobana. It means a young person. And from that we get yob, which means unrestrained, what would you call it? A bit of a scallywag young person. So there's many. And we have in Pali, the word for a doll is bimba, where we get bimbo. You all know what bimbo is, don't you? And that comes to the word like for a doll in Pali. So words actually change their meaning over time. You know, if you went for the dictionary etymology, you said, I had a terrific meditation today. How's your meditation? In English. Do you have a good time in Bodhinyana Monastery for 3 months? Yeah, it was smashing. What did you destroy? Smashing. I'm going to try. I haven't told you this story. It's just
similar story. Because I was from England, you know, poor family. So I remember just, you know, I'd learned how to, you know, shave heads, and we used to shave each other's head. It was a service which we did. And so I saw Ajay Sumato, you know. He said, oh, would you come and shave my head for me? And I said, yeah, I'll give it a bash. He said, no. To give it a bash means just give it a try. But if you looked in the dictionary and the etymology of bash means to bash it. So you can't just depend upon the meaning of words in different contexts. You know, as I say, a word only has a meaning in a sentence. So satipatthana, what sati means, what patthana is what those two words together mean. And you know what they mean by the context. Satipatthana for those four things. And sometimes say, well, why are those four things? And those four things are just basically where we think we exist. Either body, or the experience, or the mind, consciousness. Those are the places where we think, we assume, ourself is. So anyway, that is why I use focus of mindfulness, because I don't translate the words. Sometimes people make those mistakes. I always mention, because the word together, is that a good word? Together? So let's analyse it. It has three parts to it. To get her. So you've got to be careful when you analyse and split things out together. Totally different reading. If a being is made up of the five components of dukkha, and the Buddha defined the five components of dukkha as suffering, which means that cessation of dukkha is also cessation of the five khandhas, and also by implication cessation of a being. Yes, exactly. Isn't this sound nihilism, a position the Buddha clearly refuted and neglected? Yes, he did refute that. It's not nihilism. Nihilism, we didn't say nihilism, like destruction. It's, what's the word? He said it's not destroying something because there's not anything there to begin with. It's an empty process. Causes and conditions roll on with no essence in them. The empty process. So, to explain that, now you brought it up, there is a great simile in the Agivacchagota Sutta. I change it slightly, but shouldn't really affect the meaning. The Buddha was talking about a fire made of grass and sticks. And I'm going to change that to like a candle flame, which is, you know, a much easier simile to understand. A candle flame. The flame, what is the flame anyway? It's just made of three causes: the wick, the wax, and the heat. When the wick's a whack and the wick's the wacky, wicky, wacky, I've been talking too much. The wax, the wick, and the heat, they all come together, you get a flame. And when any one of those causes, any one of them, is exhausted, the wax is all used up, the wick is burnt through, or the wind blows out the heat, then what happens to the flame? Where does it go? Does it go to heaven if it's been a good flame and not burnt anybody? Does it go to hell if it's all these insects have gone into it and got burnt and they destroyed so much living beings? What is it? God doesn't go anywhere, it just goes out, that's all. Is that nihilism? Because that's what the Buddha described, the five components of existence, is caused. And when the causes stop, the five components of existence are not destroyed. They're not annihilated. It's just what was just an empty process causes, when the causes stop, so does the result stop. It's not nihilism. There is the flame, there is the cause and effect process. But when it stops, it just nibbanas. And that's one of the wonderful things when I started reading Vinaya. These were just ordinary things which happened in daily life. And when the kid said, "Mummy, the oil lamp," they didn't use candles, they used oil lamps, "the oil lamp has gone out." You know what they used to say? "The oil lamp has nibbanaed." So they knew exactly what the word nibbana meant. And even one of those chants we do, we didn't do it today, in the Ratana Sutta, about Nibbuti Dira Yatayang Padipo, that a person who is at least a stream winner is destined to be nibbanaed, just like this oil lamp. So this is understanding what nibbana is. Anatta, emptiness, there's nothing here except a process. It's not nihilism, it's not something, it's in between being and non-being, a process. We're meditating this morning, but don't think too much about that. Otherwise it drives your head crazy. You're supposed to be peaceful. Get peaceful first of all. Then you'll find out what this process really is. When meditating this morning, I told myself that the meditation and its outcome had nothing to do with me and had a really relaxing time. Is this the right way? I felt a little sad, feeling like a third wheel with nothing to do. Thank you. Isn't that wonderful with nothing to do? And there you go, you complain. If you want some things to do, let me know and I'll get you to cut up some vegetables in the kitchen. There's toilets to be clean, there's other stuff to be done. If you think you've just got nothing to do, let me know. No, it's, of course you've nothing to do. Get out of the way and let the meditation happen. I keep my body healthy by taking healthy food. Exercise. Do you think I am too concerned about the body that I can't go into deep meditation? Thank you. Oh, I take healthy food and I exercise in my dreams. I exercise every morning. I do my 10 push-ups every morning. One, two, three, four, and another five. So, those are my push-ups. But sometimes, healthy food, what is healthy food for you? Sometimes that what is healthy for one person kills another person. So you understand what's healthy food. And a lot of time, healthy food is your attitude. Good old Ted. I saw him in the hospice, Murdoch Hospice. It just opened. He was one of the first customers. Well, I call it customers anyway, he was there. And he told me the first night he was in the hospice, the nurse, it's more like a hotel than a hospice, than a sort of hospital. So they really look after you there. And the nurse said, "What do you want for dinner tonight, Ted?" And Ted said, "Well, you know, I've got blocked arteries, you know, high cholesterol," he said, "so I can't have anything sort of oily. And I've got hardened arteries, I can't have anything salty. I've got diabetes, can't have anything sugary." And this nurse looked at him and said, "What are you talking about, Ted? You're in here for cancer. You're going to die of cancer in a couple of days. You're not going to die of a heart attack. You're not going to die of diabetes. You can eat whatever you want." I said, "Really?" "Yeah." So all the food his wife would never allow him to eat, all the stuff he loved and liked and enjoyed, he ordered. Greasy, salty, sugary, sweet, syrupy to the max. And you know what happened? 6 days later, he walked out of the hospice. He was much better. He had another 6 months. And then He went in the hospice to die properly. Now, I say that because sometimes it's not just, what is health food? It's not just physical. It's emotional as well. The emotional content of that food. If it means something to you, sometimes that actually makes you better. Now that is, even as what Shakespeare said, man does not live by bread alone. Amen. It's not just, the food is only just one part of the health of the body. There's so much other stuff as well. So just look after the other stuff as well. Because sometimes, if you have to have miserable food which doesn't taste nice, it's so miserable, what's the point of staying alive? It's true, we get depressed. Anyway, the Samatha Vipassana are the same thing. Why did the Buddha say in the Majjhima Nikaya, in the Sutta named Difference, that when worldlings go to the fourth jhanas, they pass away from there and go to hell, animal realm, or the ghost realm, where his disciples attain the deathless state from those deva realms? What are the Buddhists contemplating that worldlings are not the impermanent, unsaturated, selfless nature of the jhanas versus just enjoying the body free peace? Not quite. It means that those who are stream winners and those who are not stream winners, that's the difference. If you are a stream winner and you get into a jhana, and you do lots of jhana, especially if you die in a jhana, you actually do get promotion to being an anagami, a non-returner. It's called jhana anagamis. So, but if you haven't got the stream winning and you get into a jhana, sometimes it's like a Devadatta. Was he a disciple of the Buddha? He was a monk with the Buddha all the time. He had the jhanas, but he lost them. One of the reasons people lose the jhanas is because of pride and arrogance. But once you get that arrogance, you can't get those jhanas back again. They're gone. And I saw this with my own eyes as a monk. I often tell this story because contemporary stories are just much better than the ones you read in the books because, was it really accurate? Is that really what happened? Was it exaggerated, amplified? You know, it's always the winners who write the history books. But with this monk, I just arrived over in Ajahn Chah's monastery. And this was very, very good Thai monk who started to get the ability, what they call the divine ear, to be able to hear sounds a long way away, you know, from deep meditation. They were sounds, but also human sounds. And so when he made that claim, you know, that if you're a monk, if you make a false claim, it's like the same as stealing, murdering, committing sexual intercourse. It's a parajara offense. You have to leave there and then. There's no two ways about it. You're done with monastic life for the whole of that life. And so these are important rules. So if you make a claim like that and you're just boasting, you know, you're out. It's a serious offence. So they had to check it out. And they checked it out and it was real. They gave him tests and you know, he could actually hear things a long way away. And once they realised it was real and he had his great powers, then he went to sit in Ajahn Chah's chair as if he was the abbot of the monastery. And then Ajahn Chah was really cool about this and he just took him up to his private room and talked to him and just convinced him that yes, he had a psychic power but he wasn't enlightened yet. And we know that because the next day that he bowed to all the monks, you know, in the monastery to ask forgiveness. Even me, I'd only just got there. And I didn't know really what was going on. And they told me, explained to him. And after bowing to all the monks to ask forgiveness, that his arrogance had overcame him, that then he disappeared. I think that afternoon or evening he went, I've never seen him since. Don't know what happened to him. But it was amazing just how you could see that you get something special. And many people think, oh, you know, I know as much as the abbot, I know as much as anybody. They get arrogant, they just like Devadatta. So, it does not mean that when worldlings, even call it worldlings, it means people who are not stream winners yet. They pass away from those. They don't all go to the hell realms. There was one, you know, many of them actually just go to jhana realms. And when they come back from the jhana realms, you know, that's where most people go when they die, who get jhanas. They go to the jhana realms. Many eons there. When you come back from that, you're just a really special person. And actually they're usually just the next life. You just carry on your process. You don't lose things. So you said you can go there, go to a hell realm. In other words, just like what's his name, Devadatta. But, you know, even he said that Devadatta, you know, that he would go to hell for his arrogance. He lost his jhanas at that time. And then later on, that he will sort of become an arahat. So, that's the only difference there. What are Buddhists contemplating as the worlds is not? They're all Buddhists. Some are stream winner Buddhists, some are just Buddhists who aren't stream winners yet. In a Gopika Moggallana Sutta, that's Majjhima 1:28, I think. There, just after the Buddha passed away. There, that Gopika Moggallana, he asked Ananda, when the Buddha was alive, because Ananda had been with the Buddha for 25 years, his attendant. So, what type of meditation did the Buddha recommend? You know what the Ananda answered? First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. That's the only meditation the Buddha recommended. Dear Ajahn, I've only just started meditation. I have two questions. Wow, if you do more meditation, then you're going to have more questions. But anyway, just started two questions. How do you keep your mind from becoming curious, excited, anticipatory when the stillness comes? Basically from asking, what is this, or is this it? How do I quell the questioning mind when it pipes up again? I don't know if you ever remember your science classes. You may even be a scientist. But I was trained in science classes that you just collect the data first. And you don't try and work out what the data means yet. Just collect the data, keep collecting it, keep collecting. And only when all the measurements, recordings are in, then you plot the graph to find out what's going on. So in meditation, just let the process happen first. At the end, that's when you ask, what is this? Why is this? Why did it work? Otherwise, you disturb the experiment. And a lot of times you bend the results. So using that science simile helped me to actually, okay, just leave it alone. You remember all the details later on. When you visualize peace, health, light on the breath, etc., and on the out-breath, or when you visualize the Buddha being peaceful, are these mind objects, hence hindrances and distractions to the stillness? No, they are not sort of distractions. They are mind objects, but even stillness is a mind object. These are all mind objects. If you don't have a mind object, your mind turns off. A mind needs an object. If it doesn't have an object, it just doesn't exist. So, this is, if you visualize it, it makes you peaceful. The peaceometer is moving closer to one. Good. Carry on. It's not the end, it's more to it, but that's a very good start. So you visualize peace, health, just keep on going, get very, very peaceful, see what happens next. It seems so clear that the universe is just one big sphere of liquids, energies, gases, and solids, and or something, at varying densities, changing stuff which we humans have given labels for the sake of convenience. But what which we humans have given meaning to out of childish insecurity is a vast and limitless world. It seems equally clear that these bodies, like all bodies, are little more than tubes where food goes in one end and out the other, not unlike all the other changing stuff in the universe. Ajahn, since it's quite obvious there is no bus driver, how does the letting go happen? Are there clear signs that one's sense of self is really disappearing? Of course there is. Is as you start to as yourself starts to disappear, your idea of an ego, then you are far less defensive when people come up and say, "You're not a real monk, you're a fat pig, Ajahn Brahm." And I go, oink. Or like when I went to the United States, and because, you know, you're wearing a robe, you know, they said, "What have you got under the robe, Ajahn Brahm? And is it a suicide belt?" They asked if it was a suicide belt under my robe. Didn't know it could be, but you've got sort of enough space on here. And I just opened it. I said, "No, no, it's just fat." He said, "Same thing." Suicide belt. Okay, anyway, I'll try another question. What is the difference between mind and consciousness in the Buddhist context? Mind is one of the consciousnesses. Sight, sound, hearing, smell, touch. I got one wrong. Which one did I go? Mind, okay, hearing, smell, taste, touch. And mind is the sixth sense. So, but they are different because they can just come and go. So you have mind consciousness, but my mind consciousness comes and goes. Where does your conscious and the mind consciousness go when you're under anesthetic? Is it annihilated? Where's it gone? It's not sleeping. If it's sleeping, you can poke it and wake it up. So where's it go to sleep? It's not a bed anywhere. Do you have anywhere between your ears when you open up your brain? There's a nice little bed there, a nice little duvet. That's where your mind consciousness has a nap when you're under. It doesn't go anywhere. It hasn't gone. It's not stored anywhere. Just your mind consciousness stopped. And it starts again afterwards. But where's it in between? It's nowhere in between. Just stopped. It starts again afterwards. Obvious. In reading the sutta, should we write an analysis of the commentaries and sub-commentaries like the Visuddhimagga, or should just read the suttas on its own? No, just read the suttas and rely on the analysis of Ajahn Brahm. Now use your common sense with the suttas, and sometimes the best is actually to learn some Pali if you can, so you can get some understanding, get some feeling of it, but also, if you possibly can, just read the Vinaya. Some of the Vinaya is really good fun. Okay, you know what's coming next. Paticitya number 8 for the nuns, for the bhikkhunis. This, no, we have little different rules. Parajika is, and you have to disrobe. And you've got different levels of rules. And this is paticitya. You have to go and confess it to another monk or nun. So, in the time of the Buddha, there was the nuns' monastery. It was just on the edge of town. More safety in those difficult times. But it's on the edge of town. And so one morning, one of the nuns' jobs, as a very junior nun I would expect, her job was to empty the latrine and to put all the buckets of stuff in this, I'm not sure where, but it would be in some sort of pit somewhere. That was her job. And so early that morning, you know, she must have been a bit of a lazy bhikkhuni, instead of taking the bucket of SHIT and putting it in the right place, she decided just to throw it over the monastery wall. You know, chances of anyone being on the other side were zero. That's what she thought that time of the morning. But there is something, there is a Dhamma which has been a law of physics, a law of science, which is applied in India in the time of the Buddha, as it applies today, which we've named these days Murphy's Law. If it can, I don't know who Murphy was, but he was a very smart person, ahead of his time. If it can happen, it does happen. So it did happen that morning. There was a businessman who was going early in the morning to the palace to negotiate a very lucrative contract with the king, because the king was the head of the government, and he was dressed up in his best clothes, and in those days even perfumed as well. And there he was walking on the other side of the nunnery wall, just thinking what he would say to the king, when from over the other side of the wall, a bucket of shit went right over his head. And it's amazing just how all the thoughts of the business contract just totally left his head as this ooze dripped down onto his really nice clothes. And he lost his equanimity. In fact, his hindrances took over, especially the second hindrance of ill will. And he was really angry, because he knew who was on the other side of the wall. It was the Buddhist nuns. They can't do this to me. Look what they've done to me. And they didn't have electric street lamps. They had these little resin torches, which they lit in the early morning to find the way along the roads. So he grabbed one of those and was going to go into the monastery to burn it down. I'm going to teach these nuns. Look what they've done to me, with all this nasty stuff dripping down him. And there was the gatekeeper. And the gatekeeper saw him. He said, where are you going with that? I'm going to burn down this monastery. And for one, it shows that in those days, the monasteries were mostly made of wood. They would have maybe brick foundations, but mostly they were wood. I'm going to burn down this monastery. They're not real nuns. And the man who saw this, the gatekeeper said, "Wow, you are so lucky and so fortunate. You've been blessed by holy nuns. That's very rare to get such a blessing. You know, you talk about holy water, this is holy shit." That's where that word comes from. And he said, "No, don't burn down the monastery yet." He said, "Go home. This is really lucky, really fortunate. Go home and then get changed, get washed, get perfumed again so it takes the smell away. I guarantee you're going to get a really good deal from the king today." I said, "Really?" It's amazing how superstitious people are. And they go to, where is that? That Waterloo Road temple and other temples. And yeah. Get things blessed, yeah. So he said, "Okay, I'll try it." So he went, got changed, went to the temple, went to the palace, and it worked. He got this incredible lucrative, much better than he expected, from the king. And you know what happens in business? Many of you maybe do business. The word gets around. You know, at dinners, conferences, you know, you're networking. And this guy said, "Look, if you really want good luck in business, forget about all these amulets and chanting this and that. Go for the real stuff." And of course, that's where the Buddha heard about it. When the Buddha heard about it, he told us, "Nuns, you were so lucky you had a very smart sort of gatekeeper who should be really a politician, can sell, you know, was it ice to Eskimos?" So, to Inuits. So he said, "But don't ever do that again." And so the eighth rule in the Bhikkhuni Patimokkha in Pajitya section is that any bhikkhuni who throws a bucket of shit over the monastery wall has to confess it to another bhikkhuni. You can read it, it's there. So sometimes you read these rules over there and sometimes, oh, there's some funny stuff in there. But the interesting part of it is that stories about life in the time of the Buddha. And there you get how these words are used in ordinary language, and that's where you get the meaning from. How everybody would understand the meaning of, say, Nibbana. Even kids would understand that. You wouldn't need to have a scholar. It means it's extinguished, gone. So if you read that, then you get a feeling for the time, the language, the words, the culture. And that really helps understand. So if you really want to understand the suttas, I'd read the Vinaya first. Get an idea of where it all comes from. Ajahn Chah gave several talks about training the mind rather than just following it. He used a simile of the farmer, the knowing, the buffalo, the mind, and the rice plants, defiling habits. On one talk said, you have to sometimes use a stick to frustrate craving. For those of us trained to use a stick to frustrate craving, how does one use it to frustrate craving while using make peace, be calm, be gentle to train the mind? I was with Ajahn Chah when he used the stick. With him on the arms round, and he picked up a stick and he said, Brahma Wangso, how heavy is this stick? Before I could answer it, he threw it away. It's only heavy when you hold it. That's how Ajahn Chah used the stick. That's how you train the mind with wisdom power. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it is the ego that is the greatest hindrance to clarity of the mind. If yes, how can we cultivate a daily small habit or practice to minimize the ego? Ego, she go, we all go. That was the title of one of my talks I gave a long time. The greatest hindrance is what causes the ego. Striving causes the ego. Wanting causes the ego. I am the greatest president United States has ever had. And he actually believes that. He's worked hard for that. You find that the people who strive the hardest, if they succeed, they get these huge egos. Sometimes they get frustrated and disappointed. That's a wonderful for them, because they realize they're not in control. It's not up to them. So the ego is created by wanting. Who are you anyway? What have you achieved? What have you strived for and won? How many medals have you got? Certificates? How hard work that was? That's how you make a self, from your wanting, your ego. If you failed, sometimes you get certificates for failure. You failed your driving test, you failed your bachelor's, you failed. Do you put the failure certificate on the wall? Of course you don't. You only celebrate successes, not failures. Because failures challenge your sense of ego. What would be the right thing to do if someone attacks our country in a war? Fight, flee, or all the hypotheticals. There is a war. And the attacker is Mara. Mara is the attacker. So Mara, it's how do you defeat Mara? Do you kick his ass? Do you just get out a gun and shoot him dead. The only way to destroy Mara is I know you, Mara. So, if someone attacks our country, whose country? Which is your country? I was saying the other day that, that's right, that I was learning the Indonesian national anthem. Indonesia, something Raya or Jaya or something. Raya, yeah. Why not? Whatever it is, learn as many national anthems as you can, so you belong everywhere. Wouldn't that be nice? Because anyway, I was born in England. And just, well, even the Queen of England, you know, she's got French blood, she's from Normans, from the Saxons, from the, who else? From the, not Bavaria, it was all over, Greek blood. That was from Prince, what's his name? Philip, yeah. And now, you know, if they get any, they will have Afro blood from Princess Meghan, Margon, or whatever. Megan Markle or whatever. That is, who's who? We're just all mixed up. We're all Mongols. I like the idea of Mongols. Like little dogs. A mixture of anything, of everything. So anyway, so the right thing to do with someone to attack our country, just to move to their country. While they're away. I don't know. But, you know, sometimes the nationalism... The nationalism is just so dangerous because, you know, we think that, you know, well, Singaporeans? Well, you know, are you Chinese? You English? Malay? Indian? You're just human beings. So, you know, people like to make it so that, oh, you know, we're different, stand up for your country. Well, I like to say stand up for the world. Not stand up for my country. If somebody wants to enter stream or one time returner, does one be free of any negative karma or gum? Gum is bad karma in Thai. That's why sometimes, like the precepts, keeping sila is called sin. So if you're a very sinful person, in Thailand, it means you keep lots of sila. You know, there was this Filipino, he was a cardinal, he was the head of the Catholic Church in the Philippines, and he was called Cardinal Sin. That was his name. So, anyway, there we go. So even like names are interesting, even Ajahn Chah. That's one of the reasons why I really got attracted to Ajahn Chah, being an Englishman. Anyone whose name meant tea, I thought, that's who I want to practice with, because cha is a word for tea. So I went to stay with Ajahn Tea. It's short for we cha. Anyway, does one be free of any karma? Just becoming a stream winner, you become free from negative karma, simply because you let it go, you don't carry it around with you. You see non-self. I said, why should I be an owner of my past karma? Who owns it? Who is this self which owns these things? You can let go of guilt. And it's one weird thing. Even if a person, when they die, go to a hell realm, you don't have to. It's your choice. If you think you need to be punished because some bad thing you did, then that's where you go. If you just can forgive yourself, let it go. With wisdom, with kindness, you don't need to go to hell. You don't get sent there. You choose to go. And the gates of hell are always open. You can walk out whenever you feel that you punish yourself enough. Just modern psychology is only slowly catching up with the wisdom of Buddhism. Okay, page 2. You mentioned at the morning talk yesterday about lowering one's expectation. However, how would you advise one who is already loaded with heavy responsibilities at work given by the boss, and the boss says he has no one else to give the important task to but me? This is indeed true due to lack of manpower, but I feel overwhelmed and stressed. Please turn behind. Trying to live up to the boss's expectations, sir. Thank you. Well, why don't you be the boss? And then you don't have any... You can lower your expectations and give them to other people. Is that the right way to do it? You're already loaded with heavy responsibilities at work given by the boss. And the boss says there's no one else to give the important tasks to. Well, then he has to do them himself. Is that true? So that sometimes that is just being bullied by the boss. There's no one else to give them to. Important heavy duties. But the problem is, if you keep on doing those heavy duties, you get burnt out. So tell your boss, look, I'll get burnt out. You will have no one to give them to at all if you keep giving them to me like that. So the boss learns how to give you just the right amount, not too much, not too little. You try your very best to actually to do things for the boss. But if you get burnt out and he can't find anyone to do these now, who's he going to give them to? If you have to go to hospital because you're stressed out and you get sick. So tell your boss, look, I'm already just overloaded and stressed. Any more? Have you ever heard of the straw which broke the camel's back? Any more? And if I get really sick and I can't work at all, then who would you give the work to? So, boss, we have to work this out together. So we have to find ways of actually, you lower your expectations, I lower my expectations. There was, and of course a lot of the times, the workload is all about efficiency. It's not about time. And you all know this one. How heavy is my cup of water? How heavy is it? The longer I hold it, the heavier it feels. 1 minute, pain. 2 minute, real pain. 3 minutes, agony. And very stupid. What should I do when this gets too heavy to hold comfortably? Put it down and rest. But you haven't got time to rest. I've got to do the work. Rest. Rest for a few seconds, or 30 seconds. You pick it up again, it feels lighter. Which means that if you rest during your work, real rest, not just think about worrying about things, that's not resting. Meditate, let go, put down your burdens, really relaxed. When you go back to the computer screen or just your ledger, whatever you're doing, you finally get 2 hours work done in one, because you're efficient. So you learn how to be efficient at work, productive, without getting stressed out, by understanding the nature of the mind and how it works. Giving yourself moments of rest is not wasting time, but it's making time. What Harvard Business School called an investment of time, by taking a break. Modern business practice, coming from you know who. So that's actually sometimes that lowering expectations makes you more productive. Not less productive. Counterintuitive, but it works. Try it. How does one seek repentance for past misdeeds? Go and find Doctor Who. You know Doctor Who and the Time Machine, the TARDIS? Apparently he's got a new Doctor Who adventure. I watched that when I was a kid. That was 45 years ago. He goes back in time. So find Doctor Who and then go back in time so you can mend it. If that doesn't work, you can try the chicken ceremony. You know the chicken ceremony? This was... I wrote this in one of my books. In a Thai monastery. this guy came to the monk late and he said, oh, I had a terrible argument with my wife. It's my fault. I was really bad. I'm a terrible thing. I said some terrible words about her and she threw me out of the house. Please give me help. And he said, you have to do the chicken ceremony. That's the only way to sort of, to repent the past misdeeds for your wife. I said, well, what should I do? How do you do the chicken ceremony? I never heard that before. Well, first of all, you need a chicken, obviously. And the market is still open. So you run to the market and buy a chicken, a dead chicken, and bring it back to the temple. And on the way, when you come into the temple, you know, just to save time, just pluck it. Pick all the feathers out. So when you come to the temple, I want a sort of a plucked chicken. So off he went, bought a chicken at the market, and you know, got there in time. And then when he was, you know, trying to get a nice one for the monks, and then when he came back to the temple, he was plucking it, and he got to the temple, and he gave the chicken, freshly plucked, to the monk, said, now what? He said, now you go back, have a sleep somewhere, and then come back tomorrow morning to do part two of the chicken ceremony. So off he went, so in a friend's house, and then Friday morning he came, okay, here I am again. So the monk has got the chicken out from the freezer and gave it back to him. He said, now, to do the chicken ceremony, to complete it, to show repentance and undo the past misdeeds, I want you to walk back the same way you came to the market, collect all of the feathers you plucked out the night before and stick them right back where they came from. I can't do that. I probably won't even find the feathers. I won't be able to put them back where I plucked them out from. And he said, that is the meaning of the chicken ceremony. Once bad words come out of your mouth, you can't even find them, let alone catch them and put them back in again. Misdeeds, once they're done, are done. They're out there, they're finished. So what can you do with them? Repenting them? Does that really work? Instead, learn from them and make sure such bad actions never come out from your body, from your mind, ever again. It's not repentance, it's learning. Is there anyone here who's never made a mistake? Of course we make mistakes. So what do you do with mistakes? If you punish them, we hide them. Well, I didn't do that because I'd get in trouble. The story was, there was a gentleman, not really much of a gentleman, because he was in a court in the United States accused of a capital offence. If he was found guilty, he would be sent to be executed. Serious business. And then as he was being questioned, the judge interrupted him and said, sir, you know, one moment you're saying one thing, one moment you're saying another thing. I will warn you, perjury is a serious offence in this state. So, do you know how serious perjury is? He said, yes, but I know the punishment for perjury is much less than the punishment for telling the truth. So, of course, a person would lie. They're going to face an electric chair if they tell the truth. So, politicians, do they tell the truth? It's not in their interest, is it? Husbands, do they tell the truth to their wife? She'd kill me if she found out. They really mean that. That is where lying comes from. The fear of punishment. And that is why even kids don't tell their parents what they're doing. When they really should be honest to their parents, because they won't tell you, because my mother would just be so ashamed of me, she'd blow up. It's one of the reasons why repentance and punishment drive the truth underground. And we never find out what really happened. Which means we can't really find out sort of how to fix things. Anyway, Why is it that when one's mind gets brighter and brighter, there is no feeling of peace and calm, nor feelings of happiness? just no feeling. No feeling doesn't mean feeling of calmness, isn't it? It's usually just this coming there, just wait for it. One little skillful means, if that is happening to you, take your attention away from whatever you're watching, put it on your mouth and smile. If you can't make a smile, fake one. Then go back to your mind. Sometimes it's like your mind is bright, it's like tinder dry. All it needs is that little match, that little spark of happiness, and then the joy comes up. Also, when one dies, how come one will have the Buddha or Kuan Yin or Jesus to receive them? Because when you die, there is facial recognition before you go up there, and they say, oh yeah, that is a Buddhist. Or if they see that, no, that's not a Buddhist, that's a Catholic. So they get the Virgin Mary to come and see you. And they're all waiting in the waiting room, waiting for the bell to go off. It's Catholic, your turn, Virgin Mary. No, that's a Protestant. So you have to go and get some Jesus to go. Okay, I can't resist telling stories. You know that this gentleman appeared in heaven, at the pearly gates, whatever they call it, and they asked him, just, you know, who are you? He said, my name's Joseph. And he said, yeah, what was your occupation? I was a carpenter. And he said, did you have a son? Yes, but I lost contact with him. Tell me about your son. Well, you know, he had holes in his hands and his feet. And the person, really? Wow, this is really important. Sit down, wait. This is amazing. So he sort of he text messages Jesus, and I'll get in trouble for this again. Please delete this if it's not appropriate. He does the text message, Jesus, you've got to come, you need to come now. There's someone really important. So he goes to the gates, and he sees this gentleman there just died. And he said, Jesus said, what's your name? And he says, Joseph. What was your occupation? He's a carpenter. And Jesus gets excited. Did you have a son? Yes, I had a son, but I lost contact with him. What was his son like? He said, all I know, he had holes in his hands and in his feet. And Jesus, Father, Dad! And Joseph says, Pinocchio? Please don't burn me in a... Oh dear. Oh my goodness. Okay. Oh well. Also, when one dies, how come one will have the Buddha or Kuan Yin or Jesus to see them? I think I won't answer that anymore. Why were you born into a poor family when you were most probably a monk in your previous life? Because I was used to poverty. How is it your goodness didn't give you a better rebirth? It's wonderful being poor. If I'd been rich, I could have ended up, who knows, like these really rich, spoilt brats. You know, it's like Donald Trump or like... So I had a nice kind. It's much more better to have a kind family than a rich one. Okay. Oops. That's just... In the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha often repeats the three qualities to be mindful, ardent, aware, repeatedly in his instructions in establishing mindfulness. Are these three qualities essential to each other? Or how do they relate to each other? I'll put that off till tomorrow afternoon because we're running out of time. Can you tell us what the amazing Dhamma that famous Sri Lankan monk teaches you that makes lots of stars in your head last night talks, please? Sharing is caring. I don't remember. Oh no, it was brilliant. So I don't remember the details, just it was inspiring. I think mostly because it was coming from experience rather than from theory. So that really made it really alive. It's wonderful. Because even Bhikkhu Bodhi asked her, what did he teach you? She said, I don't know. It was really good. Dear Ajahn, your Dharma teachings are wonderful. Thanks for that. great start to the question. I think I'll finish it there. Okay, there we go. I can't keep my mind attention on a single object, breath, body, feelings, at least a minute, due to forgetfulness. My mind wanders away unknowingly, but when I start thinking of an interesting thing, it keeps thinking about it for minutes. How can I keep focus on meditation for a long time? Doing nothing seems not going to work for me. Because you're not doing nothing. It's not doing nothing, it's nothing doing. So don't do nothing. But anyway, I'll give more instructions tomorrow and the day afterwards. It eventually works. If it's not working, you can't meditate and can't even watch the breath. Just sit here and imagine you're watching the breath. Imagine what it must be like to watch the breath. So don't try. It's the trying, the wanting, which is the obstacle. Tossing a coin, listening to oneself, but there is no oneself. Thank you. Indeed, but you toss a coin and you listen to one's intuition. That's what I really mean. That's also like, even today, the first person asked, Ajahn Brahm, can I take a selfie? I do not allow selfies in Jhana Grove. So please don't even ask for a selfie. Weefies. Weefies. No self. Ah, so you can take a weefie, but not a selfie. Okay, well, it's getting late, maybe your brain is stopped. You're not laughing at my jokes, or maybe, I must admit, they're not funny. We've heard it before, I don't know. Why is it that when I meditate with beginners, the mind feels like a kite in a strong wind? But when I meditate with Aryas, the mind feels like a still lake under the moonlight. So many restless, silly thoughts about food, plans, etc. come up with beginners versus almost none when I practice alone with experienced yogi. Why? The answer is, why not? So that sometimes we do pick up on the energy of others. That was a simile of the elephant. I'll go over it very quickly with you. The elephant, king's elephant, royal elephant, very well behaved, very reliable, very docile, but always really strong, so the king could ride it through the jungles really safely. But over the space of a few days, the elephant just lost his happiness and became really, really nasty and tricky and naughty. Every time the king came by, the elephant had a trunk full of water and squirted his royal highness. Whenever elephant keeper, the mahout, was right behind the elephant, that's when the elephant decided to poo. So a lot of poo comes out of an elephant, you know. Not only that, that when I was in Sri Lanka, because I was well regarded, sometimes they would lead me to one of these talks I gave in Kandy, and they had an elephant, had to have a procession to the university, you know, where they were going. I was going to give a talk, and because I was giving the talk, I had to be right behind the elephant. I was really terrified. Not only of if it pooed, because I was that close, if it passed wind, I would pass out. Now, these are big animals. It's not just a small puff. It's just, you know, a whole hurricane. So, anyway, this elephant started getting really misbehaving. So, what they did, they thought it must have got sick. Couldn't find anything wrong with it. It used to be such a well-behaved elephant. That was just really nasty and obdurate. So, what they did, it was one of the ministers. It was in one of the Jataka tales. And supposed to be the minister was a Buddha to be, future life, past life, sorry. So he said, I'll look after this, I'll find out. So instead of actually just theorizing, this minister just sat behind the elephant stall all night, meditating. And then in the middle of the night, heard this noise in the bushes. And very quietly investigated and found out that this was the meeting place of a band of thieves, planning who they're going to rob, who they're going to beat up, who they're going to even kill, what they're going to do to divide their loot, That's where they would meet every night. And even though the elephant didn't understand their language, still picked up on their bad energy, their vibes, as they say. And that's why it became a bad elephant. So the minister had all the thieves arrested the next night and invited the monks to go and meditate and teach and chant there. And even though the elephant didn't understand the chanting, still it picked up on the good energy of the monks and became a wonderful elephant afterwards. Which is why association with wise, good people helps you. So all the beginners in meditation, that associating with good, wise monks and nuns, it lifts up your meditation. You get better meditation, more inspired. And as for the good monks and nuns, you bring... it works both ways. So we get bored now. But anyway, we've got enough resilience to get back up again. So that's how it works. And you know that there's a TV program in Australia called Q&A. And I haven't seen it. Every time now and again you see a snippet of it. But somebody else told me that there was the editor of Spectator magazine was in Australia and was invited onto the panel. They were discussing terrorism and how to overcome terrorism. And it's the editor of one of these really right-wing... It's right-wing, is it, Spectator magazine? Anyway, you know, it's really intellectual. He reported that there had been a research done in Sussex University which showed that when there are monks or nuns meditating, that it just affected people around that area for days. That people became much more peaceful, less aggressive, less violent. It did have a measurable effect on the peace and tranquility of the neighbourhood. So this guy from the Spectator said, "My answer to the problems in Syria was to parachute in Buddhist monks and nuns to calm everybody down." At which point, I very uncompassionately started thinking of monks I would like to parachute. So uncharitable, Ajahn Brahm. But anyway, it does that. If you've got a partner you want to parachute in, teach them meditation. No, what it means... it's getting late. So what it means is we do affect one another. Good night. Sadhu. 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 Oh, better quit while I'm ahead. Well, I've still got my head. Oh, boy.